The limousines stop, and Nipponese people start to climb out. Dark-clad, unfunky, they stand around awkwardly in the middle of the party-slash-riot, like a handful of broken nails suspended in a colorful jello mold. Finally, Hero makes bold enough to go up and look into one of the windows to find out if this is who he thinks it is. Can't see through the smoked glass. He bends down, puts his face right near the window, trying to make it real obvious. Still no response. Finally, he knocks on the window. Silence. He looks up at the entourage. They are all watching him. But when he looks up, they glance away, suddenly remember to drag on their cigarettes or rub their eyebrows. There is only one source of light inside the limousine that's bright enough to be visible through the smoked glass, and that is the distinctive inflated rectangle of a television screen. What the hell? This is America. Hero is half American, and there's no reason to take this politeness thing to an unhealthy extreme. He hauls the door open and looks into the back of the limousine. Sushi K is sitting there, wedged in between a couple of other young Nipponese men, programmers on his imaging team. His hairdo is turned off, so it just looks like an orange afro. He is wearing a partly assembled stage costume, apparently expecting to be performing tonight. Looks like he's taking Hero up on his offer. He's watching a well-known television program called I Spy, spelled E-Y-E, Spy. It is produced by CIC and syndicated through one of the major studios. It is reality television. CIC picks out one of their agents who was involved in a wet operation, doing some actual cloak and dagger work, and has him put on a gargoyle rig so that everything he sees and hears is transmitted back to the home base in Langley. This material is then edited into a weekly hour-long program. Hero never watches it. Now that he works for CIC, he finds it kind of annoying. But he hears a lot of gossip about the show, and he knows that tonight they are showing the second-to-last episode in a 5-part arc. CIC has smuggled a guy onto the raft, where he is trying to infiltrate one of its many colorful and sadistic pirate bands, the Bruce Lee Organization. Hero enters the limousine and gets a look at the TV just in time to see Bruce Lee himself, as seen from the point of view of the hapless gargoyle spy, approaching down some dank corridor on a raft ghost ship. Condensation is dripping from the blade of Bruce Lee's samurai sword.
"Bruce Lee's men have trapped this spy in an old Korean factory ship in the core,"
one of Sushi K's henchmen says, a rapid hissing explanation.
"They are looking for him now."
Suddenly, Bruce Lee is pinioned under a brilliant spotlight that makes his trademark diamond grin flash like the arm of a galaxy. In the middle of the screen, a pair of crosshairs swing into place, centered on Bruce Lee's forehead. Apparently, the spy has decided he must fight his way out of this mess and is bringing some powerful CIC weapon system to bear on Bruce Lee's skull. But then a blur comes in from the side, a mysterious dark shape blocking our view of Bruce Lee. The crosshairs are now centered on what exactly? We'll have to wait until next week to find out. Hero sits down across from Sushi K and the programmers, next to the television set, so that he can get a TV's eye view of the man. "I'm Hero Protagonist. You got my message, I take it."
"Fabu!"
Sushi K cries, using the Nipponese abbreviation of the all-purpose Hollywood adjective, fabulous. He continues,
"Hiro-san, I am deeply indebted to you for this once-in-a-lifetime chance to perform my small works before such an audience."
He says the whole thing in Nipponese, except for once-in-a-lifetime chance. "I must humbly apologize for arranging the whole thing so hastily and haphazardly," Hero says.
"It pains me deeply that you should feel the need to apologize when you have given me an opportunity that any Nipponese rapper would give anything for, to perform my humble works before actual homeboys from the ghettos of L.A.
"I'm profoundly embarrassed to reveal that these fans are not exactly ghetto homeboys, as I must have carelessly led you to believe. They're thrashers, skateboarders who like both rap music and heavy metal."
"Ah, this is fine then,"
Sushi K says, but his tone of voice suggests that it's not really fine at all. But there are representatives of the Crips here, Hero says, thinking very, very fast, even by his standards. And if your performance is well-received, as I'm quite certain it will be, they will spread the word throughout their community. Sushi K rolls down the window. The decibel level quintuples in an instant. He stares at the crowd, 5,000 potential market shares, young people with funkiness on their minds. They've never heard any music before that wasn't perfect. It's either studio-perfect digital sound from their CD players, or performance-perfect fuzz grunge from the best people in the business, the groups that have come to L.A. to make a name for themselves and have actually survived the gladiatorial combat environment of the clubs. Sushi K's face lights up with a combination of joy and terror. Now he actually has to go up there and do it, in front of the seething biomass. Hero goes out and paves the way for him. That's easy enough. Then he bails. He's done his bit. No point in wasting time on this puny Sushi K thing when Raven is out there, representing a much larger source of income. So he wanders back out toward the periphery.
"Yo! Dude with the swords," someone says.
Hero turns around, sees a green-jacketed enforcer motioning to him. It's the short, powerful guy with the headset, the guy in charge of the security detail.
"Squeaky," he says, extending his hand.
"Hero," Hero says, shaking it and handing over his business card. No particular reason to be coy with these guys.
"What can I do for you, Squeaky?"
Squeaky reads the card. He has a kind of exaggerated politeness that is kind of like a military man. He's calm, mature, role model-esque, like a high school football coach.
"You in charge of this thing?"
"To the extent anyone is."
"Mr. Protagonist, we got a call a few minutes ago from a friend of yours named YT."
"What's wrong? Is she okay?"
"Oh, yes, sir, she's just fine. But you know that bug you were talking to earlier?"
Hero's never heard the term bug used this way, but he reckons that Squeaky is referring to the gargoyle, Lagos.
"Yeah?" "Well, there's a situation involving that gentleman that YT sort of tipped us off to. We thought you might want to have a look."
"What's going on?"
Why don't you come with me? You know, some things are easier to show than to explain verbally."
As Squeaky turns, Sushi K's first rap song begins. His voice sounds tight and tense.
"I'm Sushi K, and I'm here to say, I like to rap in a different way. Look out number one in every city. Sushi K rap has almost pretty. My special talking of remarkable words is not the stereotype bucktooth nerd. My hair is big as a galaxy, 'cause I attain greater technology."
Hero follows Squeaky away from the crowd into the dimly lit area on the edge of the shantytown. Up above them on the overpass embankment, he can dimly make out phosphorescent shapes, green-jacketed enforcers orbiting some strange attractor.
"Watch your step," Squeaky says as they begin to climb up the embankment. "It's slippery in places." "I like to rap about sweet and romance. My fond ambition is of your pants. So here is of special remarkable way of this fellow raps named Sushi K. The Nipponese talking phenomenon like samurai sword, his sharpened tongue, who raps the East Asia and the Pacific, prosperity sphere to be specific."
It's a typical loose slope of dirt and stones that looks like it would wash away in the first rainfall. Sage and cactus and tumbleweeds here and there, all looking scraggly and half-dead from air pollution. It's hard to see anything clearly because Sushi K is jumping around down below them on the stage. The brilliant orange rays of his sunburst hairdo are sweeping back and forth across the embankment at a speed that seems to be supersonic, washing grainy, gritty light over the weeds and the rocks and throwing everything into weird, discolored, high-contrast freeze frames.
"Sarari man on subway, listen for Sushi K like nuclear fission. Fire-breathing lizard, goji roar. He my always big-time hero. His mutant rap, bum down whole block. Start investing now Sushi K stock. It on Nikkei Stock Exchange. Waxes other rappers wane. Best investment, make my day. Corporation Sushi K."
Squeaky is walking straight uphill, paralleling a fresh motorcycle track that is cut deeply into the loose yellow soil. It consists of a deep, wide track with a narrower one that runs parallel, a couple of feet to the right. The track gets deeper the farther up they go, deeper and darker. It looks less and less like a motorcycle rut in loose dirt, and more like a drainage ditch for some sinister black effluent.
Coming to America now. Rappers trying to start a row. Say, stay in Japan, please listen. We can't handle competition. U.S. rappers booing and hissing. As for rap protectionism, they are afraid of Sushi K, 'cause their audience go away. He got chill financial backing, giving those U.S. rappers a smacking. Sushi K, concert machine, fast, efficient, super clean, run like clockwork in a watch, kick old rappers in the crotch.
One of the enforcers up the hill is carrying a flashlight. As he moves, it sweeps across the ground at a flat angle, briefly illuminating the ground like a searchlight. For an instant, the light shines into the motorcycle rut, and Hiro perceives that it has become a river of bright red oxygenated blood.
He learned English, total immersion, English-Japanese B-merging into super combination, so can have fans in every nation. Hong Kong, they speak English too. Yearn of rappers just like you. Anglophones who live down under sooner or later start to wonder when they get their own rap star, tired of rappers from afar.
Lagos is lying on the ground, sprawled across the tire track. He has been split open like a salmon, with a single, smooth-edged cut that begins at his anus and runs up his belly, through the middle of his sternum, all the way up to the point of his jaw. It's not just a superficial slash. It appears to go all the way to his spine in some places. The black nylon straps that hold his computer system to his body have been neatly cut where they cross the midline, and half of the stuff has fallen off into the dust.
So I will get big radio traffic when you look at demographic. Sushi K, research statistic, make big future look ballistic. Speed of Sushi K growth stock, put U.S. rappers into shock.
Jason Breckenridge wears a terracotta blazer. It is the color of Sicily. Jason Breckenridge has never been to Sicily. He may get to go there someday as a premium. In order to get the free cruise to Sicily, Jason has to accumulate 10,000 Gumbara points. He begins this quest in a favorable position. By opening up his own Nova Sicilia franchise, he started out with an automatic 3,333 points in the Gumbara Point Bank. Add to that a one-time-only citizenship bonus of 500 points, and the balance is starting to look pretty good. The number is stored in the big computer in Brooklyn. Jason grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago, one of the most highly franchised regions in the country. He attended the University of Illinois Business School, racking up a GPA of 2.9567, and did a senior thesis called The Interaction of the Ethnographic, Financial, and Paramilitary Dimensions of Competition in Certain Markets. This was a case study of turf struggle between Nova Sicilia and Narcolombia franchises in his old neighborhood in Aurora. Enrique Cortesar ran the failing Narcolombia franchise upon which Jason had hinged his argument. Jason interviewed him several times over the phone, briefly, but never saw Mr. Cortesar face to face. Mr. Cortesar celebrated Jason's graduation by firebombing the Breckenridge's Omni Horizon van in a parking lot and then firing 11 clips of automatic rifle ammunition through the front wall of their house. Fortunately, Mr. Caruso, who ran the local string of Nova Sicilia franchises that was in the process of beating the pants off of Enrique Cortesar, got wind of these attacks before they happened, probably by intercepting signal intelligence from Mr. Cortazar's fleet of poorly secured cellular phones and CB radios. He was able to warn Jason's family in time, so that when all those bullets flew through their house in the middle of the night, they were enjoying a complimentary champagne in an old Cecilia Inn 5 miles down Highway 96. Naturally, when the B school held its end-of-the-year job fair, Jason made a point of swinging by the Nova Cecilia booth to thank Mr. Caruso for saving everyone in his family from certain death.
"Hey, you know, it was just like a neighbor kind of thing, you know, J.C. boy," Mr. Caruso said, whacking Jason across the shoulder blades and squeezing his deltoids, which were the size of cantaloupes.
Jason did not hit the steroids as hard as he had when he was 15, but he was still in great shape. Mr. Caruso was from New York. He had one of the most popular booths at the job fair. It was being held in a big exhibition space in the Union. The hall had been done up with an imaginary street pattern. Two highways divided it up into quadrants, and all the franchise companies and nationalities had their booths along the highways. Burbclaves and other companies had booths hidden among the suburban streets within the quadrants. Mr. Caruso's Nova Cecilia booth was right at the intersection of the two highways. Dozens of scrubby B-school grads were lined up there, waiting to interview. But Mr. Caruso noticed Jason standing in line and went right up and plucked him out of line and grabbed his deltoids. All the other B-school grads stared at Jason enviously. That made Jason feel good, really special. That was the feeling he got about Nova Cecilia, personalized attention.
"Well, I was going to interview here, of course, and at Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, because I'm real interested in high tech," Jason said,
in response to Mr. Caruso's fatherly questioning. Mr. Caruso gave him an especially hard squeeze. His voice said that he was painfully surprised, but that he didn't necessarily think any less of Jason for it. Not yet, anyway.
"Hong Kong! What would a smart white kid like you want with a fucking nip operation?"
"Well, technically they're not nips, which is short for Nipponese," Jason said. "Hong Kong is predominantly Cantonese."
"They're all nips," Mr. Caruso said. "And you know why I say that? Not because I'm a fucking racist, because I'm not. Because to them, to those people, you know, the nips, we're all foreign devils. That's what they call us, foreign devils. How do you like that?"
Jason just laughed appreciatively.
"After all the good things we did for them. But here in America, J.C. boy, we're all foreign devils, ain't we? We all came from someplace, except for the fucking Indians. You ain't gonna interview over at the Lakota Nation, are you?"
"No, sir, Mr. Caruso," Jason said.
"Good thinking. I agree with that. I'm getting away from my main point, which is that since we all have our own unique ethnic and cultural identities, we have to get a job with an organization that uniquely respects and seeks to preserve those distinctive identities, forging them together into a functioning whole, you know?"
"Yes, I see your point, Mr. Caruso," Jason said.
By this point, Mr. Caruso had led him some distance away and was strolling with him down one of the metaphorical highways of opportunity.
"Now, can you think of some business organizations that fill that fucking bill, J.C. boy?"
"Well,
not fucking Hong Kong. That's for white people who want to be Japs but can't. Did you know that? You don't want to be a Jap, do you?"
"Ha, ha, no, sir, Mr. Caruso."
"You know what I heard?"
Mr. Caruso let go of Jason, turned and stood close to him, chest to chest, his cigar zinging past Jason's ear like a flaming arrow as he gesticulated. This was a confidential portion of the chat, a little anecdote between the two men.
"In Japan, if you screw up, you gotta cut off one of your fingers. Chop. Just like that. Honest to God. You don't believe me?"
"I believe you. But that's not all of Japan, sir. Just in the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia."
Mr. Caruso threw back his head and laughed, put his arm around Jason's shoulders again.
"You know, I like you, Jason, I really do," he said. "The Japanese mafia. Tell me something, Jason. You ever hear anyone describe our thing as the Sicilian Yakuza? Huh?"
Jason laughed.
"No, sir. You know why that is? You know?"
Mr. Caruso had come to the serious, meaningful part of his speech.
Why is that, sir?
Mr. Caruso wheeled Jason around so that both of them were staring down the length of the highway to the tall effigy of Uncle Enzo standing above the intersection like the Statue of Liberty.
"'Cause there's only one, son. Only one. And you could be a part of it.
But it's so competitive.
What? Listen to this. You got a 3-point grade average. You're gonna kick butt, son.
Mr. Caruso, like any other franchisee, had access to TurfNet, the multiple listing service that Nova Sicilia used to keep track of what it called opportunity zones. He took Jason back to the booth, right past all those poor dorks waiting in line. Jason really liked that. And signed onto the network. All Jason had to do was pick out a region.
I have an uncle who owns a car dealership in Southern California, Jason said. And I know that's a rapidly expanding area and...
Plenty of opportunity zones, Mr. Caruso said, pounding away on the keyboard with a flourish.
He wheeled the monitor around to show Jason a map of the L.A. area, blazing with red splotches that represented unclaimed turf sectors.
Take your pick, J.C. boy!
Now Jason Breckenridge is the manager of Nova Sicilia number 5328 in the Valley. He puts on his smart terracotta blazer every morning and drives to work in his Oldsmobile. Lots of young entrepreneurs would be driving BMWs or Acuras, but the organization of which Jason is now a part of puts a premium on tradition and family values and does not go in for flashy foreign imports.
If an American car is good enough for Uncle Enzo...
Jason's blazer has the Mafia logo embroidered on the breast pocket. A letter G is worked into the logo, signifying Gambino, which is the division that handles accounts for the L.A. Basin. His name is written underneath, Jason the Iron Pumper Breckenridge. That is the nickname that he and Mr. Caruso came up with a year ago at the job fair in Illinois. Everyone gets to have a nickname. It is a tradition and a mark of pride, and they like you to pick something that says something about you. As manager of a local office, Jason's job is to portion work out to local contractors. Every morning he parks his Oldsmobile out front and goes into the office, ducking quickly into the armored doorway to foil possible Narcolumbian snipers. This does not prevent them from taking occasional pot shots at the big Uncle Enzo that rises up above the franchise. But those signs can take an amazing amount of abuse before they start looking seedy. Safely inside, Jason signs on to TurfNet. A job list scrolls automatically onto the screen. All Jason has to do is find contractors to handle all of those jobs before he goes home that night, or else he has to take care of them himself. One way or another, they have to get done. The great majority of the jobs are simple deliveries, which he portions out to couriers. Then there are collections from delinquent borrowers and from franchisees who depend on Nova Sicilia for their plant security. If it's a first notice, Jason likes to drop by in person just to show the flag, to emphasize that his organization takes a personal, one-to-one, hands-on, micromanaged approach to debt-related issues. If it's a second or third notice, he usually writes a contract with Deadbeaters International, a high-impact collection agency with whose work he has always been very happy. Then there is the occasional Code H. Jason hates the deal with Code H's, views them as symptoms of a breakdown in the system of mutual trust that makes society work. But usually, these are handled directly from the regional level, and all Jason has to do is aftermath management and spin control. This morning, Jason is looking especially crisp, his Oldsmobile freshly waxed and polished. Before he goes inside, he plucks a couple of burger wrappers off the parking lot. Snipers be damned. He has heard that Uncle Enzo is in the area, and you never knew when he might pull his fleet of limousines and war wagons into a neighborhood franchise and pop in to shake hands with the rank and file. Yes, Jason is going to be working late tonight, burning the oil until he receives word that Uncle Enzo's plane is safely out of the area.
He signs onto TurfNet. A list of jobs scrolls up as usual, not a very long list. Inter-franchise activity is way down today, as all the local managers gird, polish, and inspect for the possible arrival of Uncle Enzo. But one of the jobs scrolls up in red letters. A priority job. Priority jobs are a little unusual. A symptom of bad morale and general slipshodity. Every job should be a priority job. But every so often, there is something that absolutely can't be delayed or screwed up. A local manager like Jason can't order up a priority job. It has to come from a higher echelon. Usually a priority job is a code H, but Jason notes with relief that this one is a simple delivery. Certain documents are to be hand-carried from his office to Nova Sicilia number 4649, which is south of downtown. Way south. Compton. A war zone. Longtime stronghold of Narcolombians and Rastafarian gunslingers. Compton. Why the hell would an office in Compton need a personally signed copy of his financial records? They should be spending all their time doing code H's on the competition out there. As a matter of fact, there is a very active young mafia group on a certain block in Compton that has just succeeded in driving away all of the Narcolombians and turning the whole area into a mafia-watch neighborhood. Old ladies are walking the streets again. Children are waiting for school buses and playing hopscotch on sidewalks that recently were stained with blood. It's a fine example. If it can be done on this block, it can be done anywhere. As a matter of fact, Uncle Enzo is coming to congratulate them in person. This afternoon. And number 4649 is going to be his temporary headquarters. The implications are stunning. Jason has been given a priority job to deliver his records to the very franchise where Uncle Enzo will be taking his espresso this afternoon. Uncle Enzo is interested in him. Mr. Caruso claimed he had connections higher up, but could they really go this high? Jason sits back in his color-coordinated earth-tone swivel chair to consider the very real possibility that in a few days he's going to be managing a whole region, or even better. One thing's for sure. This is not a delivery to be entrusted to any courier, any punk on a skateboard. Jason is going to trundle his Oldsmobile into Compton personally to drop this stuff off. He's there an hour ahead of schedule. He was shooting for half an hour early, but once he gets a load of Compton, he's heard stories about the place, of course, but my God, he starts driving like a maniac. Cheap, nasty franchises all tend to adopt logos with a lot of bright, hideous yellow in them, and so Alameda Street is clearly marked out before him, a gout of radioactive urine ejected south from the dead center of L.A. Jason aims himself right down the middle, ignoring lane markings and red lights, and puts the hammer down. Most of the franchises are yellow-logoed, wrong-side-of-the-tracks operations, like Uptown, Narcolombia, Cayman's Plus, Medizania, and The Clink. But standing out like rocky islands in this swamp are the Nova Sicilia franchises, beachheads for the Mafia's effort to out-duel the overwhelmingly strong Narcolombia. Shitty lots that even The Clink wouldn't buy always tend to get picked up by economy-minded three-ringers who have just shelled out ¥1,000,000 for a Narcolombia license and who need some real estate, any real estate that they can throw a fence around and extraterritorialize. These local franchises send most of their gross to Medellin in franchising fees and keep barely enough to pay overhead. Some of them try to scam, to sneak a few bills into their pocket when they think the security camera isn't watching, and run down the street to the nearest Cayman's Plus or the Alps Franchelet, which hover in these areas like flies on roadkill. But these people rapidly find out that in Narcolombia, just about everything is a capital offense, and there is no judicial system to speak of, just flying justice squads that have the right to blow into your franchelet any time of day or night and fax your records back to the notoriously picky computer in Medellin.
Nothing sucks more than being hauled in front of a firing squad against the back wall of the business that you built with your own two hands. Uncle Enzo reckons that with the Mafia's emphasis on loyalty and traditional family values, they can sign up a lot of these entrepreneurs before they become Narcolumbian citizens. And that explains the billboards that Jason sees with growing frequency as he drives into Compton. The smiling face of Uncle Enzo seems to beam down from every corner. Typically, he's got his arm around the shoulders of a young, wholesome-looking black kid, and there's a catchphrase above.
The Mafia. You've got a friend in the family.
And,
relax. You are entering a Mafia Watch neighborhood.
And,
Uncle Enzo forgives and forgets.
This last one usually accompanies a picture of Uncle Enzo with his arm around some teenager's shoulders, giving him a stern, avuncular talking to. It is an allusion to the fact that the Colombians and Jamaicans kill just about everyone.
No way, Jose!
Uncle Enzo, holding up one hand to stop an Uzi-toting Hispanic scumbag. Behind him stands a pan-ethnic phalanx of kids and grannies resolutely gripping baseball bats and frying pans. Oh, sure, the Narcolumbians still have a lock on coca leaves, but now that Nippon Pharmaceuticals has its big cocaine synthesis facility in Mexicali nearly complete, that will cease to be a factor. The Mafia's betting that any smart youngster going into the business these days will take note of these billboards and think twice. Why end up suffocating on your own entrails out in back of some buy-and-fly when you can put on a crisp terracotta blazer instead and become part of a jovial familia? Especially now that they have black, Hispanic, and Asian capos who will respect your cultural identity. In the long term, Jason is bullish on the mob. His black Oldsmobile is a fucking bullseye in a place like this. It's the worst thing he has ever seen, Compton. Lepers roasting dogs on spits over tubs of flaming kerosene. Street people pushing wheelbarrows piled high with dripping clots of million and billion dollar bills that they have raked up out of storm sewers. Roadkills, enormous roadkills. Roadkills so big that they could only be human beings, smeared out into chunky swaths a block long. Burning roadblocks across major avenues. No franchises anywhere. The Oldsmobile keeps popping. Jason can't think of what it is until he realizes that people are shooting at him. Good thing he let his uncle talk him into springing for full armor. When he figures that one out, he actually gets psyched. This is the real thing, man. He's driving around in his Olds and the bastards are shooting at him and it just don't matter. Every street for three blocks around the franchise is blocked off by Mafia war wagons. Men lurk on top of burned tenements, carrying six-foot-long rifles and wearing black windbreakers with Mafia across the back in five-inch fluorescent letters. This is it, man. This is the real shit. Pulling up to the checkpoint, he notes that his Olds is now straddling a portable Claymore mine. If he's the wrong guy, it'll turn the car into a steel donut. But he's not the wrong guy. He's the right guy. He's got a priority job, a heap of documents on the seat next to him, wrapped up tight and pretty. He rolls the window down, and a top echelon Mafia guardsman nails him with the retinal scanner. None of this ID card nonsense. They know who he is in a microsecond. He sits back against his whiplash arrestor, turns the rearview mirror to face himself, checks his hairstyle. It's not half bad.
But, the guard says, you ain't on the list.
Yes, I am, Jason says. This is a priority delivery. Got the papers right here. He hands a hard copy of the Turfnet job order to the guard, who looks at it, grunts, and goes into his war wagon, which is richly festooned with antennas. There is a very, very long wait. A man is approaching on foot, walking across the emptiness between the Mafia franchise and the perimeter. The vacant lot is a wilderness of charred bricks and twisted electrical conduit, but this gentleman is walking across it like Christ on the Sea of Galilee. His suit is perfectly black. So is his hair. He doesn't have any guards with him. The perimeter security is that good.
Jason notices that all the guards at this checkpoint are standing a little straighter, adjusting their ties, shooting their cuffs. Jason wants to climb out of his bullet-pocked Oldsmobile to show proper respect to whoever this guy is. But he can't get the door open because a big guard is standing right there, using the roof as a mirror. All too quickly, he's there.
"Is this him?" he says to the guard.
The guard looks at Jason for a couple of seconds, as though he can't quite believe it, then looks at the important man in the black suit and nods. The man in the black suit nods back, tugs on his cuffs a little bit, squints around him for a few moments, looking at the snipers up on the roofs, looking everywhere but at Jason. Then he steps forward one pace. One of his eyes is made of glass and doesn't point in the same direction as the other one. Jason thinks he's looking elsewhere, but he's looking at Jason with his good eye. Or maybe he isn't. Jason can't tell which eye is the real one. He shudders and stiffens like a puppy in a deep freeze.
"Jason Breckenridge," the man says.
"The iron pumper," Jason reminds him.
"Shut up.
For the rest of the conversation, you don't say anything. When I tell you what you did wrong, you don't say you're sorry because I already know you're sorry. And when you drive out of here alive, you don't thank me for being alive. And you don't even say goodbye to me."
Jason nods.
"I don't even want you to nod. That's how much you annoy me. Just freeze and shut up.
Okay, here we go.
We gave you a priority job this morning. It was real easy. All you had to do was read the fucking job sheet. But you didn't read it. You just took it upon yourself to make the fucking delivery on your own, which the job sheet explicitly tells you not to do."
Jason's eyes flick in the direction of the bundle of documents on the seat.
"That's crap," the man says. "We don't want your fucking documents. We don't care about you and your fucking franchise out in the middle of nowhere. All we wanted was the courier. The job sheet said that this delivery was supposed to be made by one particular courier who works your area, name of YT. Uncle Enzo happens to like YT. He wants to meet her. Now, because you screwed up, Uncle Enzo doesn't get his wish. Oh, what a terrible outcome. What an embarrassment. What an incredible fuck-up is what it is. It's too late to save your franchise, Jason the Iron Pumper. But it might not be too late to keep the sewer rats from eating your nipples for dinner."
This wasn't done with a sword, Hero says. He is beyond astonishment as he stands and stares at Lagos' corpse. All the emotions will probably come piling in on him later when he goes home and tries to sleep. For now, the thinking part of his brain seems cut loose from his body, as if he has just ingested a great deal of drugs and he's just as cool as Squeaky.
"Oh yeah? How can you tell?" Squeaky says.
"Swords make quick cuts all the way through. Like, you cut off a head or an arm. A person who's been killed with a sword doesn't look like this."
"Really? Have you killed a lot of people with swords, Mr. Protagonist?"
"Yes. In the metaverse."
They stand for a while longer looking at it.
"This doesn't look like a speed move. This looks like a strength move," Squeaky says.
"Raven looks strong enough."
"That he does.
But I don't think he was carrying a weapon. The Crips frisked him earlier and he was clean."
"Well, then he must have borrowed one," Squeaky says. "This bug was all over the place, you know. We were keeping an eye on him because we were afraid he was going to piss Raven off. He kept going around looking for a vantage point."
"He's loaded with surveillance gear," Hero says. "The higher he gets, the better it works."
"So he ended up here on this embankment? And apparently the perpetrator knew where he was."
"The dust," Hero says. "Watch the lasers."
Down below, Sushi K pirouettes spastically as a beer bottle caroms off his forehead. A bundle of lasers sweeps across the embankment, clearly visible in the fine dust being drawn out of it by the wind. This guy, this bug, was using lasers. As soon as he came up here, they betrayed his position, Squeaky says. And then Raven came after him. Well, we're not saying it's him, Squeaky says. But I need to know if this character, he nods at the corpse, might have done anything that would have made Raven feel threatened. What is this, group therapy? Who cares if Raven felt threatened? I do, Squeaky says with great finality. Lagos was just a gargoyle, a big hoover for intel. I don't think he did wet operations, and if he did, he wouldn't do it in that getup. So why do you think Raven was feeling so jumpy? I guess he doesn't like being under surveillance, Hero says. Yeah, Squeaky says. You should remember that. Then Squeaky puts one hand over his ear, the better to hear voices on his headset radio. Did YT see this happen? Hero says. No, Squeaky mumbles a few seconds later. But she saw him leaving the scenes. She's following him. Why would she want to do that? I guess you told her to, or something. I didn't think she'd take off after him. Well, she doesn't know that he killed the guy, Squeaky says. She just phoned in a sighting. He's riding his Harley into Chinatown. And he begins running up the embankment. A couple of enforcers' cars are parked on the shoulder of the highway up there, waiting. Hero tags along. His legs are in incredible shape from sword fighting, and he manages to catch up to Squeaky by the time he reaches his car. When the driver undoes the electric door locks, Hero scoots into the back seat as Squeaky is going into the front. Squeaky turns around and gives him a tired look. I'll behave, Hero says. Just one thing. I know. Don't fuck around with Raven. That's right. Squeaky holds his glare for another second, then turns around, motions the driver to drive. He impatiently rips 10 feet of hard copy out of the dashboard printer and begins sifting through it. On this long strip of paper, Hero glimpses multiple renditions of the important Crip, the guy with the goatee whom Raven was dealing with earlier. On the printout, he is labeled as T-Bone Murphy. There's also a picture of Raven. It's an action shot, not a mugshot. It is terrible output. It has been caught through some kind of light-amplifying optics that wash out the color and make everything incredibly grainy and low contrast. It looks like some image processing has been done to make it sharper. This also makes it grainier. The license plate is just an oblate blur, overwhelmed by the glow of the taillight. It is heeled over sharply, the sidecar wheel several inches off the ground. But the rider doesn't have any visible neck. His head, or rather the dark splotch that is there, just keeps getting wider until it merges into his shoulders. Definitely Raven. How come you have pictures of T-Bone Murphy in there? Hero says. He's chasing him, Squeaky says. Who's chasing whom? Well, your friend YT ain't no Edward R. Murrow. But as far as we can tell from her reports, they've been sighted in the same area trying to kill each other, Squeaky says. He's speaking with the slow, distant tones of someone who is getting live updates over his headphones. They were doing some kind of deal earlier, Hero says. Then I ain't hardly surprised they're trying to kill each other now.